12 Moons Rising on Scribble.
Welcome to Scribble, 30 minutes of conversation, comments, and reviews on reading and writing, editing, publishing, and selling books. I'm Rebecca Wehe.
And I'm Don Wooten. 7 years ago, Beth Carvey told us of a book. It's now revised and, we think, finished on Scribble.
All right. 12 Moons is the title, and we want to know, what is that warning us about, alerting us to?
Well, the book is entitled 12 Moons, A Year with the Sauk and Meskwaki, 1817 to 1818. And I have to admit that I am not very creative when it comes to coming up with titles. And so I tend to just throw it right out there. Uh-huh. And I was going to name the book A Year with the Sauk and Meskwaki, 1817 to 1818. I mean,
sure.
And then a friend of mine, Kristen Bergren, came up with the idea of, why don't you call it 12 Moons?
Yeah.
And the reason is because the Sauk and Meskwaki people did not live by a solar calendar. They lived by a lunar calendar. Mm-hmm. And I happened to have all of the names of the 12 moons that the Sauk and Meskwaki people observed in their language, with a rough translation from an 1827 document written by Thomas Forsyth, who was the Indian agent or ambassador to the Sauk and Meskwaki nations from 1817 to 1831, one of those. So it just seemed like a natural way to organize the book. And
sure.
Then why I didn't think of the title, I don't know, but I didn't.
Well, it's what we try in even composition classes when students are titling, because a lot of us aren't very good at it. And you try to make them think about an image or something that a reader will see or that will echo in their imagination, and you've done it.
Yes.
You did it.
help from my friends.
Yes. I remember reading a book with a provocative title, and it wasn't until the final chapter that the phrase actually occurred.
Oh,
in the
wow.
book.
That keeps you going then.
What? It all comes together then.
Yeah, well, I thought, oh, so that was what
Here
it was
go.
About. But what prompted you to write this in the first place?
Well, I'm retired as director of the Hauberg Museum out at Black Hawk State Historic Site, and so worked there from 1981 till 2017. Mm-hmm. A lot of our business was school children and field trips. Back in the day when schools had money and they still felt that field trips were a useful endeavor for their students, we might get 10,000 school kids a year. But they had no materials to read. So they would come in going to the Indian Museum, and they studied the Iroquois, of course, and the Sioux, of course, and the Navajo, but they didn't know the first thing about the Sauk and Meskwaki people, which were the two tribes that they were coming to learn about.
Sure.
So part of it was to give them, you know, a child-friendly, beautiful, illustrated book that would catch their interest and make them want to read, and then also to educate them that by using the term Indians, it's like saying Africans.
Mm-hmm.
You can't. You have to talk about the various tribes.
Yeah.
And each tribe was its own nation. So it's trying to get the two things across, but mostly for the students to know about the people that lived here, where they live now.
You know, it's true. I've looked at maps of the Native American nations, and boy, it really clutters the map up.
Oh, yeah.
There were hundreds of them
that
are all over the place.
Yep.
And each one has a unique story, and some have completely disappeared.
Yes.
Yeah.
Which is unfortunate, but that was the way the country was settled, rather brutally, and I would have to say maliciously. But it's nice that I notice we're now coming around to saying, okay, you're right. The treaty says this, so you're entitled to this.
Yeah.
So, you know, justice in some cases is being done, but quite late. But this is for a young adult, is that it?
You know, it was written with the idea that school children would be able to use it. However, there is enough information in here to be interesting to adults also. I think sometimes adults look at the book, oh, it's a picture book, that must be for kids. But we go into their society and culture. We go into the way the headmen, the way the council worked, you know, the democracy, the universal voting. We go into cultural things of how they divided themselves up into clans and further subdivided. So there's good information for adults in there too. And my mom did give it to a friend of hers. This was when the first edition came out, and this down in Cincinnati. Okay. So this is a member of the DAR, so we know the type of person that we're talking about here. And after reading it, she says to my mom, I had no idea that the Indians were so sophisticated.
Yeah.
Well, I'm glad she learned.
Yeah, exactly.
You know?
To give you an idea, Hiawatha was the person who talked the five warring tribes up in New England to form a more something like the United States. He was the one, and that preceded the colonies getting together as a nation. And we know of Hiawatha because of the poem, we remember the name, but that was a person of some substance that people ought to know more about. And the more you look into this, the more fascinating it becomes.
Yeah.
Oh, yes, absolutely.
Can you read some of the beginning of that so we get an idea of what you're up to?
Well, I think, do you care what I read?
No, I don't care what you read as long as the FCC doesn't complain.
I think I'm going to read a paragraph that is actually new in this second edition, and it is found on page 5 of the introduction. And it reads that the Sauk and Meskwaki had no clocks or calendars. They measured time by the cycle of the moon. 12 lunar months composed a year, though periodically an extra moon was added in order to keep pace with the seasonal activities. Each lunar month began with the new moon and ended when that moon had died. They also ordered their activities by the movement of the stars and had names for the major stars and constellations. The lunar month, coupled with the seasonal positions of the stars, told the people when it was time to plant and harvest their crops, when it was time to depart for the winter hunt in the sugaring camps, and when it was time to meet on the Mississippi to return to their summer towns and start their year over again.
It is interesting that there was a winter camp and a summer camp.
Yes.
Or a town. Saukinuk here in Rock Island was a substantial village. And they had up on the bluffs, they had their ceremonial site where they played games and so on. It's a shame that we don't really know what it looked like, because it would be nice to have a reconstruction of that.
Oh, I see.
Well, we've done our best in the museum. We do have in the exhibit orientation case, right, when you walk into the museum, we do have a scale model of Saukinuk. And that is based on a book that was published 1880s. Oh, I can't think of the name of the man that published it, but his informant was Bailey Davenport, who as a child would have spent a lot of time at Saukinuk. And so it's based on his memories of how the town was laid out in that particular area.
So I misspoke. We do have some good idea of what Saukinuk must have looked like.
And we do have a drawing from an 1820 document of the Meskwaki town, Wabalaz town, that was right across from where Fort Armstrong is now.
Okay.
And it clearly shows the houses in a row, and just as we know that they constructed their town. So we do have an actual map, sort of, of Wabalaz town, but not Saukinuk. Darn you!
Well, The unfortunate thing is that they did move.
Oh, yeah.
And they would move from Saukanuck out to the plains. And while they were gone, settlers started moving into their homes. Mm-hmm. And when they came back, they found, wait a minute, someone is in my home.
Yes.
But the Indian tradition was that, you know, if you found something, it was yours. And so it was a little unsettling. I don't think they exactly knew how to deal with this because possession, you know, they said the idea that you can own property is silly.
That's what I was just recalling of the very little that I ever learned as a kid about Native cultures was that you didn't own the land. You didn't claim it, you know, that this is yours and not yours. But is that not right?
Oh, they had very strong feelings of territoriality.
Well,
huge, strong feelings of territoriality.
Okay.
But in terms of could any one individual own a piece of land? No.
Yeah.
Okay. And it wasn't until much later, say among the Meskwaki that moved back to Tama, who figured out the rules of the game.
Sure.
If I want to have ownership of this piece of property, I have to have a piece of paper that shows it belongs to me. But okay. No, that's something was totally foreign to Native peoples.
Yeah, you know, the idea that the earth belongs to the Great Spirit and we're just here for our time and we use it and don't abuse it. And the earth just keeps going and we pass by.
Yeah.
That's not a bad way to look at the world, is it?
No.
Well, and I don't remember if this is native in a sort of broad sweep or a particular group or tribe, but the idea that any decision you made in your lifetime about how you were going to live or what you were going to eat or any of that, you had to be thinking what the impact would be seven generations ahead, which is, we certainly don't do that. You know, and that's, we wouldn't be in the fix we're in terms of global warming. And, you know, that was a little nugget that I remember carrying because it was fascinating to me to think not just your own kids or your own grandchildren, but all these generations ahead, if what you're doing right now isn't going to serve them, then you've no business.
Well, and I think that traditionally balance was just an extremely important part of their way of living. Their spirituality is totally caught up in the earth and all of the guardian spirits that are in trees, flowers, rocks, birds, fish, so on and so forth and so on, which makes us all related because we all get our life from Grandmother Earth, and therefore you treat your relations with respect. And by that being such a huge part of just the definition of who they are, that just brings about the balance all by itself.
Sure.
You told us why you wrote the book. How did you go about it?
Well, actually, Tom Wilcoxon, who is my co-author, came to us with an idea.
Uh-huh.
He had done some work for us, paid for by the state of Illinois, for the orientation exhibit we have and then a fur trade exhibit back in the back of the museum. So he came to me with these sketches and this idea of doing this book. And he'd been peddling it actually to a number of well, not that particular book, but other books to other historic sites with books that were for them. And we were the first ones that said, yeah, I'll be your guinea pig.
Yeah.
So that's what got it started. He came with this idea, and then we had a grant writer who was out of this world, and we were able to get the funding for doing it, and, you know.
And again, the listening audience can't see what we can see, but it's beautiful. And so who did that?
That's Tom. All of these illustrations are Tom's. He put everything together in Publisher. I sent him my text. He would work it in so that, you know, he'd say, oh, you have to take out three words.
And
beat your brains out to find three words that are expendable. But then he put it all together in the files, was able to send the files to the publisher.
Okay.
So he was very, very knowledgeable. We could not have done it as economically without him.
It is a very attractive book. Where would someone be able to buy this?
You can purchase it at the museum at Blackhawk State Historic Site. I think over at the Book Rack in Davenport, they have got copies, so they can be sold there. Those are the two places locally. And then it has been sold before down at Cahokia Mounds and Field Museum up in Chicago and other historic sites and museums.
Yeah, you mentioned that this is a second edition.
Mm-hmm.
Why was it necessary to go back, or
was it
necessary at all? You just had nothing to do. I mean, what's going on?
No, there were some things that needed to be corrected. Mm. For example, in the first edition, when you look at the orientation or the introduction page where we have the phases of the moon.
Yeah.
In the first edition, they're backwards.
Oh, no.
Nobody caught until the darn thing was published. And then it's like, oh, no. So we definitely wanted to get that corrected.
Yeah.
And then also, I was fascinated with how the Sauk-a-Meskwaki kept track of the moons, because you have to add an extra moon in there. If you don't add an extra moon to keep pace with the seasons, then eventually you're going to wind up trying to tap the maple trees in July. You can't do that. So I actually was able to figure out, by lining it up with the Jewish calendar, when that extra moon is added. And so that extra moon does fall in February or January of 1818, so it's included in the book.
Okay.
Yeah. So that was something that I just found, you know how a problem just niggles at you and niggles at you. And finally with the second edition, it's like, okay, I'm going to sit down and figure that out. And then Tom also, this was Tom's idea, added at the back of the book two pages that are a visitor's guide that show the local area. So if you want, shows where Saukonek was in Wabalaz Town.
Okay.
So if you want to take a drive around there, you can.
Oh, that's
it
great.
Shows the Mississippi River corridor from the Quad Cities up to Dubuque and various historic sites that you can see on the along the way. Also the locations of the Meskwaki towns and what present day town they're near now, so that it has more meaning for people. And then on the other page is a regional map that shows Chicago and Milwaukee and St. Louis and just various other native sites, museums that people can visit.
When did you finally finish the second edition?
When did we get it done? I think we finished it in May.
Oh,
and it came out.
Mm-hmm. Just this year.
Well, we started it way back in 2019.
Yeah.
And then COVID hit. And my grandson, who was 2.5 at that time, his daycare was closed. So he was home with me for 4 months.
Uh-huh.
I never was a stay-at-home mother, and now I know why. Oh, no.
No, it's true.
They're tiring, let me tell you what. So just with the pandemic, everything really just got off kilter. So it really wasn't until this January that we started working hammer and tongs at it, and then got it done in just a few months, our corrections.
Oh, wonderful.
Yeah.
So the second edition is what we want to look for.
Oh, yes, absolutely.
Get the moons in the right order.
Yes.
Well,
although we had thought about adding a prize for school kids. Look at this book.
Oh.
Anybody that can find what's wrong on this page gets an A for the day.
Excellent. Well, so then the 12 moons that titles that, is that where we get all the different names we have for, you know, a blue moon or or is that something else entirely? Is that a different?
Yeah, blue moon and super moon that are used now, those are meteorological terms.
Okay. Doesn't
because,
have anything to
right,
do with...
a blue is a blue moon where you get two full moons in a month.
I think so, yeah.
See, but you have to be tied to your solar calendar.
Yeah.
They didn't have a month.
So
they, right? They didn't know that there were two full moons in August. They didn't have an August. What's August?
Sure.
So
they weren't named in that way at all. It was just a tracking. It was kind of a timekeeping device, but they didn't give them.
I mean, there were, you know, there's first frosty moon. That's the one that's, I think we're in right No, we should be coming up on that one. The full moon for First Frosty Moon will be September 10th this year.
Okay.
Yeah. And then Rutting Moon after that. Well, that's, you know, the deer are running.
Sure.
And then Freezing Moon and so forth and so on. So they do keep pace with kind of seasonally what's happening.
Sure, of course.
Beth, and that, I'm sorry.
What, are you normally one who writes, or is this a one-off job for you? Do you do other writing?
Oh, my gosh, that was a big part of my job. Yeah. I mean, I've never written a book before, but I've written articles that were published in Historic Illinois Magazine, for example. Obviously, articles for the newsletter. I've written up, I don't know how many different pamphlets on various historical aspects of Black Hawk State Historic Site. But this is my first book.
Yeah, that's wonderful.
What led you to Hallberg Museum in the first place? How'd you wind up there?
It was a job. I had graduated in 1980 from Eastern Illinois University with a master's degree in museum administration. Okay. So I did my internship over at Bishop Hill and then got my first job down at the last home of Thomas and Sarah Lincoln down south of Charleston, Illinois. And then the job at Black Hawk came open. It was a promotion for me and an opportunity to work in more of a museum setting, which I was more interested in. And that's what brought me here. Not because I knew anything about Indians, because I didn't.
Oh,
I used to laugh about that and tell people, oh, when I first came here, I thought Indians all hunted buffalo and used bows and arrows and lived in teepees and, you know,
cliche.
Yes, exactly, that you can think of. Well, I didn't know any different. So I've spent the last 40 years learning a lot. And if you spend your job every day, almost learning something new. I mean, it was like I'd died and gone to heaven.
Yeah.
I'm very, very thankful to have had the opportunity to work there.
I wonder how many people drift up there to the museum. It's not something that you see from the roadway and so on. You have to kind of know where you're going to get there. Has traffic increased, decreased, or, you know, it's you ask museum people what it's like, and as the age changes, as people get fastened to their iPhones and computers, they don't get out very much.
This is true. And I've been retired for nearly 5 years. Of course, the pandemic, I think the museum was closed for nearly a year. Because of that, you know, it's just what it is. And so the school tour business is just starting to build itself back up again.
Yeah.
But the woman who is director of the museum now, Julie, she is wonderful. Oh, my gosh. Young, excited, great ideas. She really loves doing special events, things to bring families in. Ugh, she's great. So I think that she does everything she can, but I don't know what the visitation numbers are and if it's recovered since the pandemic.
Yeah. Well, I think that's going to be a job for everybody.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, definitely.
It doesn't make any difference whether you're running a museum or a restaurant.
That's right.
How do you get a flow back in?
Get back out there.
Yeah.
Well, because they talk about returning to normal, give that up.
No.
That's not going to happen.
No.
We're creating a new normal, and I hope we can do a better job of it while we're at it. But it's great to have that book, and it's good to know that it's available at, you know, in more than one place. Are you tempted, now that you're retired, to still write further articles and things, or have you laid down your pen for good?
No, I have so much research that I have done. If I ever get my act together, I really want to write a story about the Sauk and Meskwaki from about 1817 until their expulsion in 1831, and just write it from, here's what was going on with the government, here's what was going on with the Sauk and Meskwaki, you know, here's, I think I have another one too, but just how, and the fur trade, and how those three things all worked together and kind of grew at the same time and then collapsed at the same time all around this about 1831 date. And also with the major players. They were all of about the same age. They were all born about white people and some of the Indians, all born about the same time. So they had all lived through the same changes, right, that were going on the frontier here as more and more people are pouring in, white people are pouring into the state. So, yeah, I really want to do that.
Oh, good. Good, good, good.
But that's really going to be a huge amount of work.
Well, I mean, are you thinking of articles or are you thinking of another book?
Oh, I'm thinking of a book.
Yeah. Oh, well, I mean.
Excellent.
Why not? But that's going to take a long time.
Yeah,
so what else have you got to do?
I mean, well, once my grandson goes to kindergarten, I'm hoping I'll have a little bit more time. He's in daycare all day, but, you know, still on days he has to stay home. And,
You know. Well, so then, because this one was sort of initially envisioned to be aimed at children, is that still an audience you want to work with, or doesn't that really matter to you? Would you be thinking,
Is your new book for kids or grown?
No, it would be for adults.
For adults.
Uh-huh. It'd be a history book.
Okay.
Well, you still have to think of a catchy title for
it. That's right.
Oh, dear.
Yeah, but, you know, it's hard to write about historical subjects because you can get drowned in details. And then it's hard for the narrative to flow on and to lead the reader on. So it takes a couple of different skills.
Yeah. You have to be, what I've decided, is a good storyteller.
Yes.
And the history books, I mean, I'll read history just for pleasure, and I'll read the most whatever. But if I'm recommending a history book to a non-historian, I will say, this author is a fantastic storyteller.
Yes.
You will be swept along with the narrative. And I think that's what's needed That's the best way to do it.
I think so.
But you have to get all your facts together first.
Well, I've got all the facts. I just have to put them together now.
Oh, well, all you have to do is sit down and write. That's it.
No. You've got to start getting, you know, okay, what was going on in this particular year? What was going on with the fur traders? What was going on with the American government? What was going on with the Indians? And make it, because it's got to be a chronological story.
I was going to say, is that the best way to organize that then?
I know how to organize it. Yeah. Maybe that's because I'm an historian, so states.
Yep.
Well, plugging ahead year by year is as good a way as any. But, you know, there are certain points where the drama quotient rises.
Yes.
And that takes a little bit more. Well, Beth Carvey, I'm impressed and pleased that you now have a final copy of 12 Moons.
Yeah.
The moons are in sequence.
And if you buy the book, you'll notice that now on this introduction page that has the cycles of the moon, we have each moon named.
Okay.
And it starts in September. And it starts in September because that's what Thomas Forsyth did.
Okay.
He started his list in September, which is why I chose the Jewish calendar to align it with. I could have chosen the Chinese calendar, the Asian calendar, because that does also.
Yeah.
But okay. Rosh Hashanah, New Year.
Beth, thank you very much. We appreciate your being here. And the
thank
book
you.
Is 12 Moons, and you can find it at the Hallberg Museum and other places. Good idea to pick it up and read it. See you next week.